From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Obamacare survives again. The Supreme Court gives the president a big win.
After multiple challenges to this law before the Supreme Court, the Affordable Care Act is here to stay.
Boston bomber Jahar Tsarnaev ended his long silence. Bombing survivor Lynn Julian did not like what she heard.
I regret having ever wanted to hear him speak because what he said showed no remorse.
And after the massacre in Charleston, calls in South Carolina to remove the Confederate flag from Capitol grounds.
Bring it down! Bring it down! Bring it down!
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. We've got breaking news here just in. I've been told we've got a decision from the Supreme Court on same-sex marriage. So let's go right to Emily Bazelon, joining us from New Haven, Connecticut. She's a staff writer for The New York Times, senior research fellow at Yale Law School. Emily Bazelon, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
So break down the decision. It just came in. What do you know?
Well, I can only barely break it down because I just started reading it, but the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, has recognized gay marriage throughout the country. So states everywhere will be granting marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples, and they will also be recognizing marriages that are performed in other states.
So what does this mean then exactly for states that did not allow same-sex marriage? Will they be forced to allow that now immediately?
That is my understanding from the opinion. I'm not sure about the immediate part. I just haven't gotten far enough into the opinion to be sure about that. But it's a majority opinion written by Justice Kennedy, and the dissenters are the conservatives on the court. There's a dissent by Justice Scalia and a second dissent by Justice Thomas.
So talk about the ramifications for gays and lesbians in this country, including tax benefits, hospital visitations, you know, joint adoptions, among other things, with this ruling today, 5-4 decision written by Justice Kennedy saying that the 14th Amendment requires a state to license a marriage between two people of the same sex. Emily Bazelon.
Well, this has been an enormous civil rights battle for gays and lesbians throughout the country, one that has been hard fought in the courts and also through voter referenda and legislation in some states. And because of all these previous efforts, gay marriage is already legal in 36, 37 states. So this is a change of the law in the remaining states, and it means that we're going to have one law about tax benefits and adoption rights, all the benefits that come with marriage, all the rights and responsibilities, that is going to be a national rule. And I think that in the end, that will be a big relief, not just for couples, but also for companies who worry about relocating people. Having one rule for the entire country in the long run is going to be much smoother, as well as the issues of fundamental justice here.
Talk about your interpretation of the breakdown of the court, of the Supreme Court on this issue, a 5-4 vote.
You know, I mean, I think there was some thought that it was possible that Chief Justice Roberts might vote with Justice Anthony Kennedy and the liberal wing of the court in favor of gay marriage. In the end, we didn't see that happen. And so this is a 5-4 relatively divisive and ideologically divided decision. But 5 votes on the Supreme Court is still a majority. And so in that sense, you know, the dissent has its say, and that's an important part of the process. But in the end, it's the 5-vote majority that counts.
The 14th Amendment was at the heart of this. The 14th Amendment has been at the basis of most landmark civil rights cases for Black Americans in this country. It enshrines equal protection under the law. The court clearly finding here that the same principles apply to gay Americans as well.
That's right. And what we see here is an evolving understanding of what equality and liberty mean under the Constitution. This is an amendment that was written after the Civil War to grant mostly African Americans equal rights. And we've seen it expanded since then to ensure the rights of women and other religious and ethnic minorities. And now I think we're seeing a recognition by the court that gay and lesbian couples deserve the same kinds of protection.
The justices have been deliberating on this since April. I guess it was a federal appeals court ruling in Cincinnati that upheld bans on same-sex marriages in Kentucky and Michigan and Ohio and Tennessee, right? Four of the 13 states that only allowed heterosexual marriages. Remind us of the genesis of this, Emily.
That's exactly right. There are still, you know, on the books bans in those states and others throughout the South and other parts of the country that are more conservative. And the question that's become more pressing over time is whether every state should be recognizing the rights of gay and lesbian couples to get married, or whether this was a state-by-state decision. And I think the fundamental shift you're seeing here on the part of the five-justice majority, and particular Justice Kennedy, is one that is away from states' rights and towards the idea of equal civil rights for everybody. The last time the court decided a gay marriage decision, it was a states' rights plus gay rights decision. This time, in important ways, those two values were at odds, and Justice Kennedy went with the rights of gay and lesbian couples. Hmm.
Breaking this morning, the court has ruled on gay marriage, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, saying the Fourth Amendment requires a state to license a marriage between two people of the same sex and to recognize a marriage between two people of the same sex when a marriage was lawfully licensed and performed out of state. Emily Bazelon, thank you so much for being with us and explaining this. I know it was short notice. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me and trusting me with this important piece of news. I appreciate it.
Indeed. Emily Bazelon, staff writer for The New York Times and senior research fellow at Yale Law School. So let's bring in our roundtable now. Charles Babington of the Associated Press, Yamiche Alcindor, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Yamiche Alcindor covers national breaking news for USA Today. Yamiche, welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, Charles Babington is with us. He covers Congress and politics for the Associated Press. Chuck Babington, we're glad you're joining us as you head off into retirement. What a day to do that. Welcome back.
A pretty busy week, Jane.
Yes. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty is with us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Chuck, and Yamiche.
So got to get a reaction here. Chuck Babington, you first. This is a very important day, the big decision at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, I'm not suggesting the Supreme Court makes its decisions on a political basis. That said, I'm not surprised by the ruling. I've, in all my time in journalism, I've not seen any important social issue change as rapidly as gay rights has. Nothing else seems to me to compare to the rapidity and the dramatic nature of the change. And I think the court is just, you know, seeing, is recognizing that either from a legal or political basis. It would have been quite shocking, I think, at least to the American political system if the decision had gone the other way.
Yamiche Alcindor, how do you see it?
I think it's a watershed moment for a lot of people around the country. I have, frankly, friends who have been waiting for this, people that are really thinking about how the court sees their rights, how the court sees their humanity. And I think the court is now reflecting how people around the country feel. I think this is something that changed very rapidly. But I also think that people's ideas about gay marriage changed very rapidly in this country. You have the President Obama who said, you know, his ideas were evolving on this. And I think that the more that people really got to know people, the more that people really got to understand the longevity of same-sex relationships, that people, the issues that people would bring up against it just kind of fell by the wayside. So I think as a reporter who kind of really does a lot of street reporting and talks to people about their lives and at times of struggle, I think that this is really the court reflecting what the greater nation already wanted.
Jack Beatty, talk about how quickly the issue of gay marriage has taken root and gained acceptance in this country.
Well, Justice Ginsburg spoke to that in a recent interview. She was asked, why so fast with gay rights? Why so slow with equal rights to African Americans? And she said, well, with gay rights, once people came out of the closet, and that took a lot of courage, we looked at such people and said, that's my neighbor. That's my friend. That's my son or daughter. And it was suddenly it's an us question. They are us. But she said, given segregation in America, race is still us and them. And I thought that was a really a profound question about and explains why it went so fast. And it also explains why racial progress is so slow.
Justice Anthony Kennedy read the ruling this morning. Chief Justice The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court has the principal dissent on this, which is 29 pages long, John Roberts. Toward the end of it, he has said here, if you are among the many Americans of whatever sexual orientation who favor expanding same-sex marriage, by all means celebrate today's decision, celebrate the achievement of a desired goal, celebrate the opportunity for a new expression of commitment to a partner, celebrate the availability of new benefits, but do not celebrate the Constitution. It had nothing to do with it. That's Chief Justice John Roberts. He's now reading his dissent from the bench. It is the first time he's ever read a dissent from the bench. Chuck Babington, what do you make of that?
Well, I don't cover the court, but my understanding is for a justice to read any decision from the bench, what he or she is trying to do is emphasize, bring greater attention to that decision. And it's especially interesting the position that Chief Justice Roberts is in this week. You know, he wrote the opinion up upholding Obamacare and angering a lot of conservatives. Here he's siding with the other three conservatives that he typically does, and it puts Justice Kennedy back in his familiar role of being the pivotal person here. So in the matter of 2 days, Justice Roberts has been really on the side of the conservatives on one big issue and not with them on another big issue.
And Jack Beattie, Justice Scalia, I'm reading here, has his own dissent. He leads off by saying that the decision, quote, is a threat to American democracy. Jack Beattie.
Well, I suppose what he means is that voters in states who voted for constitutional amendments banning gay marriage, that now is trumped, is overruled by, you know, nine people on the Supreme Court. But that is our system. We have a system of judicial review. We have a system of constitutional construal. And the justices have spoken. And now it's for the country to conform.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news, and you can join the conversation. Big week at the Supreme Court. Also, are you calling for the Confederate flag to be taken down? What do we need to do as a country to stop racism, to heal old wounds in the wake of Charleston? Chuck Babington is with us from Washington, a reporter covering Congress and politics for the Associated Press. Yamiche Alcindor, national breaking news reporter for USA Today, is with us from New York. And On Point news analyst Jack Beattie in Hanover, New Hampshire. We talked the first block about the Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage, big ruling, 5-4, legalizing gay marriage in this country. We're going to dig into this issue in our next hour. If your station does not carry us, you can listen live online at our website, onpointradio.org, or you can listen to our podcast later. We'll dissect this ruling as we know more about it. Let's go now to the Affordable Care Act and the Supreme Court ruling yesterday that President Obama's health care law may provide nationwide tax subsidies to help poor and middle-class Americans buy health insurance. Here he is speaking in the Rose Garden after the Supreme Court decision. President Obama saying that the Affordable Care Act is no longer a political football. It is here to stay.
The point is, this is not an abstract thing anymore. This is not a set of political talking points. This is reality. We can see how it is working. This law is working exactly as it's supposed to. In many ways, this law is working better than we expected it to. For all the misinformation campaigns, all the doomsday predictions, all the talk of death panels and job destruction, for all the repeal attempts, this law is now helping tens of millions of Americans.
On the other side, Republican Senator and presidential hopeful Ted Cruz reacted to the decision on the Senate floor. He called the six justices who sided with the administration rogue Houdinis.
Millions of Americans have seen their health insurance premiums skyrocket, and it is a direct result of President Obama, of Democrats in the United States Congress, and of lawless judges at the United States Supreme Court who have joined the team of the Obama administration. If those justices want to become legislators, I invite them to resign and run for office. That's the appropriate place to write laws, on this floor, not from that courtroom.
Chuck Babington, covering Congress and politics for the Associated Press. Ted Cruz there also calling this ruling an act of judicial tyranny. This was a huge win for the president, though. Talk about what happened yesterday.
It was a huge win, and keep in mind that Chief Justice Roberts was in the majority and wrote the opinion. So when Ted Cruz and others attack him, and there will be a lot of people attacking him, keep in mind he's a Republican appointee and really and has been in many ways a champion to conservative causes. It's obviously a big win for the president. The president said this is no longer a political talking point, and of course what he's trying to say is that this is settled law. However, it certainly will remain a political talking point in Republican circles and definitely within the Republican presidential primary. This is a winning issue with the Republican base. At almost any conservative or Republican audience you go to, if you criticize Obamacare, there's going to be applause. It's just an article of faith. And so I think to a person, the candidates running for the Republican nomination will continue to attack and criticize it, as will the Republican leaders of Congress. So the politics cannot be taken out of this issue, and the nation remains largely, more or less evenly divided on this topic, as they have been from the very beginning, from the day it was signed into law. So the politics of it will not go away.
Mm. Yamiche Alcindor, there were many reports this week that the White House almost lobbied for this ruling, essentially challenged the Supreme Court to rule otherwise. Health and Human Services Director Sylvia Burwell saying there is no plan B here. It would be a disaster if this were repealed. What do you make of what happened this week?
I think it's really a testament to the fact that this law is already in effect. People already are, millions of people are already using this law and already really are examples of how this law is changing people's lives. So I think them daring the Supreme Court to really rule against this law is saying, I dare you to take away your neighbor's health insurance. I dare you to explain to people how they're going to now have to go back into the past and live without health insurance and really live without the basic human rights that some people think they should get, which is really health. And this idea that you can actually go and see a doctor and not have to live out of emergency rooms to try to get primary health care. I wrote a long story a couple years ago about a woman who had been going to the emergency room for at least 20 years as her primary source of health care. And she was a working woman. She lived in Southeast D.C. She was a working poor woman. And to imagine that the Supreme Court would somehow now take away the health care that the president had given her, it is a dare. And it's, of course, some people will disagree and say that, that woman should go and find another way and that spending primary health care in the emergency room is the wrong way to go about things. But I think that's what that dare is the idea that people are already living with this law.
Mm. Jack Beatty, Justice Scalia wrote a scathing dissent on this ruling, describing it as interpretive jiggery-pokery. He said the Supreme Court does not have the power to rescue Congress from its, quote, drafting errors. He said we should call this SCOTUS care, meaning Supreme Court care, not Obamacare. And then Chief Justice Roberts took the lead in the decision, writing the majority saying Congress passed the Affordable Care Act to improve health insurance markets, not to destroy them. So this could have been a narrow ruling. It was not. It was a very broad ruling, correct?
It certainly was. And, it's historically, this decision really assures President Obama's place in the pantheon of progressive presidents. The progressive vision dates to Enlightenment philosopher Immanuel Kant. He held that the role of government should be, quote, to hinder hindrances to individual freedom. FDR hindered the hindrance of old age with Social Security. LBJ, the hindrance of sickness in old age with Medicare. Barack Obama has hindered the hindrance of life without health insurance with the Affordable Care Act. But, of the three presidents, Obama is the most progressive. Both Social Security and Medicare are financed by regressive payroll taxes. The ACA financed chiefly by a variety of taxes on the affluent and business. If you want to make enemies, Woodrow Wilson said, try changing things. Barack Obama is a change-making president, and he has the enemies to prove it.
Chuck Babington, the serious legal challenges to Obamacare are over, but the political challenges continue. All 13 Republican presidential candidates vowed to repeal Obamacare. Is this a litmus test in 2016?
Well, I don't even know if you can say it's a litmus test among Republicans, Jane, because there's such unanimity. I think I said that word wrong. They all agree on that Obamacare is the and it's interesting. You don't even hear a lot of detailed discussion. It's a winning talking point to say Obamacare is terrible. It should be overturned completely. And again, that's the applause line that's going to be at any Republican rally. I think what's really interesting, if you look at the two decisions of the Supreme Court this week, the two big decisions, and looking at the presidential primary coming up, the Republicans are in a bit of a quandary, I think, over particularly over gay marriage. It's I think a lot of Republican leaders realize that it's just that the sentiment has changed so much that it's not a winning issue to be you can say I oppose gay marriage, but if you and then kind of move on to other topics, but if you pound the table on that topic, it's likely to cause a candidate trouble in a general election. Mm. And yet their problem is that a lot of the very conservative base reporters who supporters who turn out in primaries and caucuses are still adamantly opposed. So whereas opposing Obamacare is an easy winning talking point for any Republican, opposing gay marriage is a problematic talking point.
Is there a real political movement afoot, Yamiche, to do something about Obamacare from a Republican perspective? I mean, aren't the politics and the reality of a repeal very different, actually taking away services from millions of people who now have them? Yamiche?
I think that Republicans in some ways have really kind of sat down and really thought that this is the way that we can win elections, that this is the way that we can have people rally behind our party. As the other guest said, this idea that you can get applause by saying that you're going to repeal Obamacare. But with the Supreme Court ruling the way it has ruled, I would find it very hard for the Republican Party to now really be able to launch a campaign against Obamacare, thinking about the fact that we have so many other things in this country that they could be attacking and that they could be talking about. And I think that that is probably where maybe a lot of Republicans are going to be thinking about now that say, okay, same-sex marriage has been ruled on. We probably shouldn't be talking about that at our campaigns. Okay, now that Obamacare has been ruled on, maybe we could move on to something else. However, Republicans understand their base. They understand what brings people out to elections. And I can completely see a situation where they continue to rally people against Obamacare just for the fact that people are going to be excited about it and people it's something that people can easily rally behind.
Let's go to Nancy, a listener from Omaha, Nebraska, on this issue. Nancy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
My comment about the Supreme Court decision is that I wish that the people who oppose it so strongly would work on instead trying to improve the affordable part of the act and controlling drug costs, device costs, and exorbitant profits that the hospitals make. You know, Obamacare was really kind of an insurance part of the puzzle. I wish they would work on the affordable piece next instead of trying to scrap it entirely.
Nancy, thank you. Jack Beatty, to that point, is there room for improving this law among Democrats and Republicans, or is it a simple up and down? You're either for it or against it.
I'm afraid that's true, but I think Nancy really raises a crucial point, especially on drug prices. You know, Medicare is barred by law from bidding down, using its purchasing power to bid down drug prices for recipients. That's because of the Bush was written, was also voted on by the Democrats, his expansion of Medicare to cover prescription drugs. That is a huge loophole, and it's costing taxpayers billions, or aggregately, and it's a gift to the drug industry. Now, Big Pharma is winning big time on trade with this trade bill, and it would be nice if somehow someone could say you're gonna really clean up in international trade now. Maybe we can use the government's power to get a better price for people on Medicare. Mm.
Let's move on now to what happened in Charleston, South Carolina this week. President Obama today delivers the eulogy at the funeral of the pastor killed in the massacre of 9 people at the Emmanuel AME Church. Yamiche, you were in Charleston this week. Tell us what you experienced there.
I was in Charleston this week and last week, and what I experienced was really a community of people that were shocked by the level of hatred that Dylann Roof walked into a Wednesday night Bible study, and the idea that someone could hold such racist values, drive 2 hours, sit around people for more than an hour talking about Christ and talking about their faith, and then kill them. I think people were still really shocked by what they were by the idea that this could have happened. But I also think I talked to a lot of people, and the Nation heard them talk at the court hearing for Dylann Roof, that they were really talking also about forgiveness and the idea that this happened in the Bible Belt of the United States, that people here really believe in their faith and really wear it on their shoulders and really live it out in their daily lives. So that's kind of what I experienced. The other thing that we're going to be talking about is the idea of the Confederate flag, being that I had not really seen the Confederate flag in where I live, but the idea that the Confederate flag in the South, especially in South Carolina, can be found right on the state capitol grounds was something that was really debated and something that is really having a passionate reaction to. A lot of people are now kind of really applauding the South Carolina governor, Nikki Haley, for talking about the fact that that flag needs to be removed. And the other thing that people are really talking about, which I thought was really important, was the fact that this is happening right now, that this flag had been part of conversations for years, and that the NAACP had been boycotting South Carolina for years. Mm-hmm. But the idea that now, because of, you know, it's a political year and it's kind of political posturing, and you can now get dozens of politicians to come out and stand around the governor and say, yes, we agree on this flag. A week ago, before 9 lives had been lost, this would not have happened. So I think that there's also this idea that in all of this, there's still politics really playing around in the background of all this.
Of course, pictures of Dylann Roof, the alleged shooter in Charleston, brandishing the Confederate flag, have led to a lot of debate about this. Here is Nikki Haley, as you say, Amish, Republican governor of South Carolina, on Monday calling for the Confederate battle flag flying on the grounds of the state capitol to be taken down.
The murderer, now locked up in Charleston, said he hoped his actions would start a race war. We have an opportunity to show that not only was he wrong, but that just the opposite is happening. My hope is that by removing a symbol that divides us, we can move forward as a state in harmony, and we can honor the 9 blessed souls who are now in heaven.
Chuck Babington, what do you make of these calls from around the country, really, to remove these symbols of the Confederacy?
What strikes me, Jane, is Dylann Roof also posed in those photos with the Confederate flag, also in some of them with a handgun, a Glock handgun, presumably the one that he used to kill 9 people. And what you have is, at least in Washington, but also elsewhere, is a lot of talk about removing the Confederate flag, very little talk about any advancement on any kind of gun control. And, of course, we've seen that repeatedly, after the terrible shooting of young children in an elementary school. The president tried to make a fairly modest move about gun registration, not registration, but background checks, and it got nowhere. You know, we talked about how much the Nation has moved on gay rights. It's hardly moved at all on gun rights for years and years and years, and that's just kind of a locked-in position. So there is, I think, there's plenty of momentum now to get the Confederate flag taken down. It's sort of interesting that there's almost no momentum for any change in gun laws. Mm.
Jack Beattie, Charles Blow writes in the New York Times this week asking, quote, when do we move from our consensus over taking down symbols to the much harder and more important work of taking down structures? Are we focusing on the wrong thing here?
Well, it's a big question, isn't it? I mean, you know, the Confederacy lost the Civil War, but it really won the battle over how it's remembered. 60% of young Americans think it was fought over states' rights, and only 38% of Americans as a whole think it was fought over slavery. When one is happy in forgetfulness, facts get forgotten, Robert Penn Warren wrote during the war's centennial. The chief forgotten fact was memorialized by Mississippi's secessionist convention. Quote, our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery. The Confederate battle flag stands not for the lost cause, but for the worst cause men ever died for. It's long past time. Take down the flag. Rename the schools, the descendants of slaves, especially of the 180,000 who fought in the Union Army. They shouldn't have to spend another day in buildings named for the paladins of the slave power.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, 21 days and counting in the manhunt for two escaped prisoners in upstate New York. Major Charles Guess with the New York State Police says the escapees are likely to be armed.
Just about every cabin or outbuilding in the North Country has one or more shotguns or weapons, and we have since day one operated under the belief that these men are armed. They're extremely dangerous. They're cunning. Why wouldn't they try to arm themselves immediately upon escape?
A historic win for golfer Jordan Spieth. At 21 years old, he is the youngest golfer to win the U.S. Open since 1923. And after winning the Masters in April, he's halfway to a Grand Slam, winning the four major tournaments in the same year in golf. Here's Spieth after his win on Sunday.
I don't really think of my age. I just think of us all as peers. And it's cool to be able to have, two legs of the Grand Slam now and to conquer golf's hardest test.
And Oscar-winning composer James Horner died in a plane crash at 61 years old. He wrote the music for over 100 movies and won two Oscars for his work on the movie Titanic. Well, before the break, we were talking about the Confederate flag coming down. A lot of callers on this point. Let's go to Tony from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Tony. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Okay, I'm calling from the town of James Island, which is essentially surrounded by the city of Charleston. And what has been so uplifting is that many, many local mayors and have been coming out in support of Governor Healey to take down the Confederate flag. However, in the town of James Island, where I live, where the first shots of the Civil War were actually fired, the local mayor and most of the council are refusing to come forward in support of Governor Healey. They're not being public about it, and I'm just calling because I'm frustrated with there's still so many local politicking going on around this issue when, as your previous callers have echoed, there is a strong sense of unity in Charleston, and there's still these behind-the-scenes things going on that are very, very disturbing. Mm.
Tony, thank you. They're from Charleston, South Carolina, the heart of this. Aaron is in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jenny.
Hi, go ahead.
I just have three quick points I want to make.
Okay.
The first one is there are literally tens of millions of whites in America that profess to be liberal, non-discriminatory, and progressive, and they need to start standing up and being outraged at what's going on. Also, the flag in over that state capitol building was put up in direct opposition of the civil rights movement in the 60s. That is these lame excuses about it being some historical thing. No, it was put up to purposely say that we are against any equality for blacks. The last thing is that whites have to become so intolerant of the biases that's going on that it has to change. We have to start reflecting the change in the laws and everything that we do. We can't tolerate this any longer, but until we start being outraged outwardly, not privately, but outwardly, then it's never going to change because these people are able to hide behind the scenes and continue to do stuff like the previous caller said, do their little politicking and backroom things where they can keep things the same.
I got the message, Aaron. Thank you so much. I'm glad you called. I want to get another one in here. Bob, another listener from Jamestown, Kentucky. Bob, welcome to the program.
It's a hot issue here in Kentucky right now. Kentucky being a border state in the Civil War, right now there's movement in our state legislature to remove Jefferson Davis' statue out of the state capitol. I mean, Jefferson Davis is a native son. But, you know, after all, Jane, the war was over 150 years ago. The South was defeated. So when you lose the war, the flags come down. You can't fly a swastika in Germany to this day. So, I mean, like I say, when you lose the war, you know, you can't put your flag up.
Time to take down the flag. Bob, thank you. Thank you very much. I want to play some sound here from an interview posted on Monday on the WTF with Mark Maron podcast. This is President Obama speaking about race relations and the slow path to ending discrimination in the United States. Listeners, this clip does contain a racial slur that many would find offensive.
Racism, we are not cured of.
Clearly.
And it's not just a matter of it not being polite to say nigger in public. That's not the measure of whether racism still exists or not. It's not just a matter of overt discrimination. We have societies don't overnight completely erase everything that happened 200 to 300 years prior.
Chuck Babington, your response.
Well, obviously, the president's word choice got a lot of attention. Maybe it pulled a little bit of attention away from the larger point that I think he was trying to make, is that this is a huge issue. It's been a huge problem for this country and will continue to be to some degree. And I think what he's saying, you can't expect rapid, you know, change overnight, as he said, but we should continue to keep pressing. I think that's the point the president was trying to make.
Yamiche, your thoughts on this?
As I was listening to the president talk about this, I was thinking about an interview that I did with a man who was at the Wednesday night Bible study and at the church really only an hour before that Dylann Roof came in and killed those 9 people. And he said to me that racism is like water poured into the ground. He said that it is something that nourishes certain parts of our society. It's something that continues to be fed to people. And it's something that's going to take a really long time to get out of their system. But he said that we really need to take an overt and strong stance against it and to really continue to talk about it. Because if you think about water poured into the ground, you really just have to continue to really just almost have the sun bake it out of the system. And that's really what this man was talking about, this idea that he was almost a victim. And when he was able to reflect on what happened and how his life was saved, he could really just think about that. And the only other thing I wanted to talk about with this idea of the flag, I talked to Walter Scott's lawyer while I was in Charleston. Walter Scott, of course, is the man who was shot in the back that most of the country watched as that police officer shot him in the back and is now charged with murder and is actually now in the cell next door to Dylann Roof. He told me that he understands people that want to have the Confederate flag in their homes, that want to have it in, you know, family albums, that want to have it in their personal life. It's a difference to be able to think about your great-grandfather who fought in the Confederate on the Confederate side and say, you know, I really like that part of my history. I'm happy that I can still think about that and still think about that person. However, to have it fly on the State House grounds, to have it in stained glass windows in the National Cathedral in Washington, that is now also saying that they're going to be taking down those windows, to have them in those public places is really what this conversation is about. And as Jack said, this really needs to be about, and Chuck said, I think, as well, that this really is about this idea that we need to, as a nation, understand who won the war. And that's different than you personally saying that my great-grandfather, again, was in the war. So I think that that's kind of what I think about when I hear President Obama talking about race relations and talking about this.
A lot more in the news this week. A couple of items here. Republican Governor of Louisiana Bobby Jindal on Wednesday announced his presidential campaign. He spoke about protecting religious liberty and conservative values, criticizing other GOP candidate Jeb Bush.
You've heard Jeb Bush say that we need to be willing to lose the primary in order to win the general election.
We're going to help him do that.
Let me translate that for you. I want to translate that political speak into plain English. What Jeb Bush is saying is that we need to hide our conservative ideals. But the truth is, if we go down that road again, we will lose again.
In Boston, marathon bombing survivor Henry Bogard spoke at a news conference on Wednesday after the formal sentencing of marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev.
I have forgiven him. I have come to a place of peace, and I genuinely hope that he does as well.
Let's go to the phones. Eitan from Austin, Texas, has some thoughts about the week in the news. Eitan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for the phone call.
Yes.
My call is about the series of attacks that happened today in France, Kuwait, Somalia, and Tunisia. Looks like it could be possibly like a series of coordinated attacks. And, you know, I am so appalled that this is not getting more mention on your show. It's not the first thing being discussed. I mean, this looks like a really major series of terrorist attacks. And
let's get to it now, Eitan. Thanks for bringing it up. In Tunisia, about 27 people, but the number is rising, have been killed in today's attack of a beach resort. A gunman exchanged fire with security forces. A second gunman is being sought. In Kuwait City, ISIS claimed responsibility for a deadly explosion that struck a Shiite mosque in Kuwait's capital after Friday prayers. At least 16 people killed, dozens wounded. And then in France, authorities say an attacker with suspected ties to French Islamic radicals rammed a car into a factory near Lyon. One man was apparently beheaded. Jack Beattie, they do sound linked, at least connected in some form.
Yes, certainly chronologically, if not in inception and planning. And as Bruce Riedel, the former CIA official on counterterrorism, mentions in the Times today, the Kuwait operation, that hasn't happened before, and it's in a Gulf state. It's alarming, and you know, it raises the question: are we winning against ISIS? And which raises the further question, could we win? Is there any conceivable strategy that would prevent this terrorism from being a feature of modern life? And it seems the answer is no. I mean, if in the end this is about the beliefs of very disturbed marginal people inspired by quasi-religious imagery deeply alienated from their society, if it's about somehow preventing them doing these things, that's an impossibility. The very conditions of modernity generate these people. So we're in a dialectic here. The world is generating war against terrorism is generating terrorists.
Here's an eyewitness account, Jack, of the attack this morning at a tourist hotel in Tunisia, recorded by Sky News. Two British sisters were staying at one of the hotels on the stretch of beach where the attack took place. They were right by the beach in their hotel when the attack started.
We heard some gunfire, but she didn't know what it was. My sister knew what it was because she
sounded like machine gun.
Everybody just started running in and screaming, and the whole place just cleared.
Clearly an ongoing, evolving story, which we'll, of course, continue to follow. Chuck Babington, let me bring you in here again domestically. Another big win for the president this week on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Congress passed first fast-track authority. Explain what that was about and what it means going forward.
Yeah, Jane, a big win. Back you up just a minute. The TPP has not come to Congress yet. This is a big global 12-nation trade agreement that's still being negotiated. What did pass was the TPA, and I try to not use these acronyms in my stories, but and that is better known as Fast Track Authority. And what it lets – and previous presidents have had it. It lets a president present Congress with a proposed trade agreement that Congress can vote up or down but cannot change or filibuster. And it's the only way to have a chance for an agreement to be passed in Congress. So this was a very big win for President Obama. The politics of it were very strange because the vast majority of Democrats, especially in the House, were adamantly opposed to it. And so it really was the Republicans who, by nature, are more pro-trade. It was up to them to really carry him through on this. But now, Jane, attention really will turn very much to some trade agreements, starting with the Trans-Pacific Partnership that includes Japan and Canada and Vietnam, not China, by the way. And the liberals who lost this round are going to be looking very hard at details of this agreement and quite possibly asking Congress to defeat it.
Yamiche Alcindor, let me ask you about the State Department this week saying that 15 emails sent or received by Hillary Clinton were missing from records that she has turned over, raising new questions about whether she deleted work-related emails from that private account she was using exclusively in her office. Expect a subpoena of the server in Mrs. Clinton's home, Yamiche?
I expect something to happen. I don't know if it's a subpoena. I think that something that they're going to, this is going to be an ongoing conversation for her, which of course is going to really complicate her ability to really run successfully and become president of the United States. Whether or not there's a subpoena coming or whether or not it's just going to be a barrage of questions and the continual bringing up of this, I should say, at political debates, if she ends up in political debates, which I imagine she will. So I don't know if there's going to be an actual enforcement of like Secretary Clinton's emails, but I think the idea that people are still kind of trying to understand what this really means for people who don't understand personal servers versus in your home and how security works. I think people in some ways are still wondering what she might be hiding. And some people are wondering whether or not this is just, you know, a conversation about emails and that this has nothing to do with now her political aspirations going forward. So I think that this will definitely still be a conversation, but it's hard to say whether or not a subpoena will follow.
Well, let's end where we started here. Let's loop back to the big news of the day, the Supreme Court ruling that same-sex couples have the right to marry in all 50 states. President Obama just tweeting that gay marriage, that this ruling, quote, is a big step in our march toward equality, end quote. Chuck Babington, wrap up this ruling and these milestone events this week in our country.
Well, I tend to see things through a political prism because that's what I cover. Politically, it was a great week for President Obama with the win on the trade agreement and the two Supreme Court decisions on Obamacare and gay marriage. You know, obviously, it's a horrific week in other ways for this country, and he's in Charleston today. But Obama has had a pretty tough second term in many ways. This is probably the best week he's had in a long, long time.
Jack Beatty, your wrap-up thoughts on this week?
Yes, and it's a good week for America, too. I mean, we're a better country now. I mean, that's just the fact. There's no reason to that the gay Americans can't have the same can't marry, can't they love, they can marry, they can that they can be full and equal citizens, and that's just a great thing.
Thank you very much. A terrific panel and lots of news breaking in this hour. Chuck Babington, thanks so much. Enjoy your retirement, sir.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Thank you. Yamiche Alcindor, reporter for the USA Today paper. Thanks to you, Yamiche.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Jack, thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.